Welcome to the Look Far podcast, Voices from the Wild. Join Look Far Conservation as we talk to conservation leaders from around the world about their work, their life, the challenges they face, and the successes they've had.
I felt as DOB ecology, we should focus on biodiversity, on ecosystems, repair those ecosystems, help organizations to restore them. That, in my view, is one of the biggest weapons, one of the most effective answers to the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with having, you know, a foundation focusing on climate change, but we felt that we should go one layer deeper and look at the ecosystems that sustain us, thinking about how we can prepare those systems for the impacts of climate change. So there's a lot of climate adaptation, if you wish, in our portfolio. Not always explicit, but a lot of stuff that our partners do on the ground is actually not just restoring ecosystems, but making folks in those ecosystems, but also the ecosystems themselves more resilient to climate change.
Welcome back to the Look Far podcast. We're here still in the Canandaigua Reserve, run by Fundación Hokotoko here in Ecuador. And joining us today, really excited about this, we have Maas Goot from DOB Ecology, a Dutch charitable foundation that supports forest and wetland conservation and restoration projects, including Hokotoko and some of its really important conservation work. And we also have my Look Far colleague and our Chief Operations Officer, Marlies Carino, joining us. And Marlies, it's Goot, right? Or am I mispronouncing it?
It's actually Grote, but you can say Goot. Okay. I think it's better.
All right, yeah. That's good. That's
good. Stick to Goot.
Marlies is Dutch-Portuguese, so she's got us covered on multiple continents, multiple countries. Maas, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Scott. Fantastic.
Really glad you could make it.
Yes, lovely that you could join us, Maas. So tell us, for starters, you are the first CEO of DOB Ecology and designed what is now a substantial portfolio of conservation programs. Could you tell us more about your strategy and your thoughts behind the creation of this portfolio and the conservation programs?
Yes, well, that's a big question. When I was asked to join DOB Ecology in the beginning, which was 2016, the first assignment was to make a strategy. What will we do? Why will we do it and where? The short story is that we had to make some decisions. I mean, you could do wonderful work, useful work on almost
anywhere spot. In the world.
Exactly, yes. So in the end, we decided to focus on the African continent and South America, okay. Two continents. And we decided to focus on forests and wetlands. Mm-hmm. Forests, because there is actually no environmental problem around where forests don't play some kind of role in its solutions. I mean, forests are crucially important for a lot of solutions. And wetlands because, and it may be different now, 2021, but especially in 2016, we're underfunded. Mm-hmm. They're crucially important ecosystems. They are the workhorses often, you know, for many, many functions. And we felt that we're underfunded. So we decided Africa, South America, forests and wetlands. But still, and this, you know, may sound a bit technical, but we want to have an ecosystem perspective. You know, you can't just focus on forests only or on wetlands only. You want to look at the landscape, right? So in the end, forests and wetlands are important habitats and features, but any project that we approach is looking at the landscape. What's needed in that landscape? Mm-hmm. Restoration, conservation, and the folks that live there, the local communities, help them support them, empower them to be part of that longer-term vision for the landscape.
Interesting. Well, we'll get more into the details of that, but can you tell us, because you weren't always involved in conservation, you actually trained as a lawyer, you went on to become the lead climate negotiator for the Netherlands and later for the EU, and then you became the head of IUCN Netherlands. Those are all high positions with influence and big organizations, and you left and chose to actually work for a low profile, smaller organization. So could you tell us why the change all of a sudden after a long career?
Wow, so you basically asked me to explain my whole career. You have to answer for yourself, Mas.
Yeah, there's a distinct change in direction. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I understand your question, absolutely. Well, I haven't planned my career. I mean, some people do, I didn't. I was trained as an international lawyer. I did a lot of work. I had the privilege as a junior legal counsel to work for the Dutch government on many multilateral environment agreements. You know, MEA is the jargon for that. Biosafety, biodiversity, ozone, long-range transboundary air pollution, climate change, all that stuff. And I learned a lot in that, you know, in these fora on international policy making, negotiations, political interests. It was very fascinating. I learned a lot eventually from being a legal counsel. I became head of delegations to different forums, different MEAs, different agreements. And later on in my career, in my governmental career, I should say, climate change really trumped the agenda. So in the last years, I was almost exclusively working on climate change. Yes, I made the switch for several reasons. The first reason is I got a call and with a question to whether I was willing to set up or help establish DOB Ecology, which was a tremendous opportunity mm-hmm. for me. So the important thing was this opportunity came along, like earlier opportunities came along, not planning
right.
them.
Right.
And but to tell you the truth, honestly, I was a bit frustrated by the international processes at that point. I think it's only the Montreal Protocol on ozone where I really felt that the international community made some solid progress towards a solution. But in so many of the other MEAs, I felt the opposite. Slow process, not a recognition of the emergency that we felt as a global community. So the opportunity to join DOB Ecology was just amazing because it allowed me to go from, you know, the international arena to work on the ground, to look at what's happening in reality, on the ground with local organizations. And DOB Ecology, you know, being the CEO, that allowed me that opportunity to make the switch from talking about stuff, mm-hmm. policies that I increasingly felt were not effective, towards supporting organizations on the ground where, in my view, the real change happens.
People are actually
That's
doing
where
the
it
work.
Takes. Yeah.
Okay, so why not then create a portfolio around climate change or mitigating climate change with DOB Ecology? Why not make that the main theme? Because it's not.
It's not. No, climate change is a global crisis, absolutely. But I felt and still do that we have to go to the root causes of that. What's happening on the ground with biodiversity, with species, with the health of ecosystems? The stronger ecosystems are, the better and more resilient they are to, you know, combat climate change or absorb these changes. So I felt as DOB Ecology, we should focus on biodiversity, on ecosystems, repair those ecosystems, help organizations to restore them. That, in my view, is one of the biggest weapons, one of the most effective answers to the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with having, you know, a foundation focusing on climate change, but we felt that we should go one layer deeper mm-hmm. and look at the ecosystems that sustain us, thinking about how we can prepare those systems for the impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of climate adaptation, if you wish, in our portfolio. Not always explicit, but a lot of stuff that our partners do on the ground is actually not just restoring ecosystems, but making folks in those ecosystems, but also the ecosystems themselves more resilient to climate change.
Mas, maybe we could dig into that a little bit more, because you're right that DOB Ecology, when it's looking at organizations, looking for programs to fund, maybe the worst thing to do when pitching you an idea or a concept is to start with climate. You know climate, but that's not what your interest is. You're focused on biodiversity, you're focused on the landscape. And yet, I think like you said, there isn't a project in the DOB Ecology portfolio where you couldn't account for the carbon being sequestered in trees, in soil, you know, whatever. And a little harder to quantify, but the way in which protecting, preserving, even restoring forests, wetlands, and so forth enhances the resilience of local areas and can play a big role in climate adaptation. But I feel like while you've departed from sort of the climate policy sphere, and while climate is not an express priority of anything DOB Ecology is doing, in fact, by focusing on biodiversity, by focusing on conservation and restoration, you're still managing to have a lot of climate bycatch in all the work that you're doing. Would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. In fact, we talk about climate change and fighting climate change every day around the programs and partners we support. So, absolutely. But it's important to realize that, at least that's our perspective. First, climate change is high on the political agenda. So, biodiversity is less, is less prominent on that agenda. So we feel as DUB Ecology that we could make a bigger difference by focusing on those programs that look at restoring biodiversity, restoring ecosystems. But more importantly, it is a huge contribution. If you do it right and if you restore ecosystems, it's a huge contribution to and in our fight against climate change. So, you know, every ecosystem that you restore, every wetlands that you protect is contributing to our effort to fight climate change.
Yeah, and in fact, so we're here in the Canandaig Reserve in Ecuador, in the Esmeraldas province. This is the work of Fundación Hokotoko. And we were just talking with Martin Schaefer a little while ago, the head of Hokotoko, a two-time podcast guest now. And, you know, to the east is a very large national park here in Ecuador. Canandaig Reserve lies downslope from it by several hundred meters. Martin was telling us about how the species and, you know, the biodiversity here is extraordinary. As we've talked about with Martin separately, the number of new species that keep getting discovered, never before described by science, in Canandaig is really remarkable. And by connecting the lower-lying areas of the Canandaig Reserve to this much higher, you know, above 700 meters national park, you're creating a corridor, a kind of emergency escape route for species that might not survive a warming planet in the decades to come. And migrating upslope is their opportunity. And I don't know about you, but I was really just blown away in the way Martin kind of repositioned the Kanembe Reserve, which is such a conservation effort, as, you know, kind of a climate emergency exit in and of itself. I mean, I was really struck by that.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you look at the climate crisis, there is adaptation and mitigation. And the global community, NGOs, funders, everyone involved, corporations, you know, consumers, we all have to really think about how to mitigate climate change. But at the same time, the climate adaptation is protecting ourselves from the impacts that will occur. And you're right, Scott, in this landscape, I mean, if we have an increase globally on average, 1.5, 2, 2.7, you know, things will change in this landscape. Species will move upward because of that difference in temperature. You can't stop that in the short term. So that's climate adaptation. What happens in this landscape? What can we do? And with we, I mean folks like Martin and his organization, Yoko Toko, we as funders to support them, to make sure that this ecosystem can absorb these impacts of climate change and can actually survive.
You know? The species can move higher here. Actually.
The species move upward.
In this ecosystem.
Exactly. But they can only move upward if there's actually a corridor, a space for them to
protected
move towards.
Protected area. Yeah. It's still pristine.
Exactly. Yeah. Rather than, you know, a timber company cutting down the trees or something. So that is climate adaptation in its purest form. Make sure that this ecosystem is connected, is healthy and restored, so that the impacts of climate change, temperature rise, species moving upwards, flora and fauna, by the way, can make can absorb those changes. And so it's not climate adaptation or climate adaptation. No, it's both. But we, with our partners, focus on restoring ecosystems so that they contribute to us handling and absorbing the impacts of climate change that will happen despite all the current efforts.
And is that why you tend to work with small local NGOs? Is because they know the landscape intimately and actually identify the possibility, the opportunity of creating this emergency corridor here? It's very zoomed in. It's not something you can see on satellite images, but at the same time, you want to have scale, or you want to work with maybe a larger organization because they're better organized, or how do you see that?
That's a good question. You know, the climate crisis, but also the biodiversity crisis, mind you, is of such an intimidating magnitude that you could, you know, it could paralyze you. So for me, scale is not necessarily scale in one place in a huge volume with a lot of, you know, scale to me is many different initiatives that produce results in many different locations. And if you add it all up, that scale, it's often very difficult, you know, in reality, on the ground, to immediately, in terms of size or geography, think about a gazillion hectares, right? I know it's compelling, and it's always, you know, glamorous to talk about, well, we're going to have X amount of hectares. But in reality, you need 10 groups that work on 100 hectares rather, you know, than one group that focuses on scale of a thousand.
A thousand, and then does it medium rather have 10 high quality projects that actually produce results long term?
Yeah, exactly. And I have nothing against, you know, those efforts, but it's our conviction that yes, scale is important, but you need to know and understand what you're doing at a smaller scale for it to, you know, then be scaled up. And that's why we support local groups, because they live there, they understand the landscape, the folks in those areas understand, you know, the environment, they depend on it, and you want to involve them in their watershed, in their forest, mm-hmm. to make an effort, and so it's, you know, these hectares are important, even though it's not a gazillion hectares. If you have 100 hectares, 1,000 hectares, 2,000 hectares, those are just as important compared to, you know, big splash efforts.
Well, and Mas, you know, I mean, we've seen size really be misleading. There was a project in the Atlantic Forest, a relatively small land purchase, a little more than 300 hectares, but it connected surviving fragments of the Atlantic Forest, one of the most endangered forests in the world, less than 7% of its original cover is still there. And this small but very strategic 300 hectare purchase that DoD Ecology supported led to the protection of more than 10,000 hectares and the connection of them, including a certain overpass over the highway.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that to me represents exactly what you're talking about.
No, absolutely. I mean, and we have many examples, you know, from the partners we support. The connectivity is crucial. So you start with 200 hectares, you restore it, and you connect it to another piece of forest, and you will have a connected area of 10,000 hectares. Now, that's not small. You know, even the 200 hectares are crucially important for the folks who live there, for the golden lion tamarin monkeys in your example, that have their, you know, habitat there. And the value of these projects, although in hectares perhaps they're not as glamorous or as newsworthy as the big, you know, the big ones, are actually making the change on the ground.
So Mas, I want to try something on for size with you. You know, another friend of mine, also works for a donor that supports conservation work, often quite big projects, really wasn't totally comfortable with this notion of scale always being better, because he said scale too often gets interpreted only in terms of size, number of hectares or acres if you're in the United States. And he said scale can also be time. Scale can be quality. Scale can be the depth of the grantee's connection to the landscape and their connection to the communities living in and around the area in which the conservation work is being practiced. And so scale isn't well served if it's understood solely in terms of size. That seems to fit with DoB Ecology's approach, but is that how you think of it, or do you have kind of a different approach to it?
No, I can recognize that. I mean, it sounds a bit, you know, cliche, but quality to us is more important than scale. Because you can't scale up if you don't have the quality first. And if you have the quality first, then you can try to expand things. But so yes, I mean, scale is overrated. And I understand why. It's, you know, it's glamorous. It's big. It's, you know, we're gonna be changing this whole thing.
And everybody's talking about it because we need to change because climate change. We need carbon projects, big money.
Yeah.
Hectares.
Yes. And actually we do. But for me, scale is 10 local organizations producing, you know, solid, long-term, sustainable results.
That's with the scale. Communities.
With the communities in the landscape where they live and work and will stay. That's scale. So you need, scale to me is 10 projects on a focused, quality-oriented landscape, rather than one project with a gazillion hectares. Mm-hmm. So that's the paradox. We are in a hurry. There is a crisis. But it doesn't mean that we have to take one big giant leap that is...
And then fail massively.
Exactly.
We've overlooked the details. Yeah.
Because there is a crisis, because there is an emergency, we have to make sure that 10 groups, 20 groups are empowered to make progress rather than one big group and a headline. And yeah.
So if that is the strategy, 10 super good local groups, my last question would be, if you would have a limitless budget, what would you do? And would, in fact, money be the solution, the key to the solution?
That's a very good question. And the answer, like all of these things, is not straightforward. A couple of things. First, a project of 100,000 euros compared to a project of 200,000 euros doesn't mean that that 200,000 euro project is twice as good mm-hmm. as the 100,000 euro project. So there's no linear, no causation between the size of the money and the results that come out of it. You can have a great, high-quality program that delivers, you know, results for 50,000 euros. That is, in terms of its quality, in terms of its sustainability, in terms of its inclusion of local, you know, communities, is much, much better than...
longer-lasting, more significant, will actually be used.
Compared to a project
right.
Of... three times the size in terms of funding. So the size of the funds are not necessarily directly linked to the results of it. So and again, this sounds a bit cliche, but quality first. What is the track record? What is the knowledge of these folks in that watershed or in that landscape? What is what they're good at? What is their commitment to that is more important than the size of the grant and the financing. Having said that, and sometimes, even speaking as a donor, that is a bit unfortunate, money is always important. So there's no two ways about it. I mean, funding is important. But I think it's not so much the size of the funding that determines the success. It's how organizations on the ground are empowered to do what they're good at that makes the difference.
So the difference is actually more what you do with the money than just spreading lots and lots of money thinly all over.
I believe so.
Yeah.
And there is, in my view, a need for any donor to be modest. Modesty in a sense, you can't or you shouldn't determine what the recipient organization is doing. You should trust that they know best. And you should advise on certain points, but not micromanage or dictate what they should do. If you know it as a donor better than the organization in the field, do it yourself as a donor.
Yeah, or find another partner.
Find another partner, yeah. So
the partner is crucial, I hear.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the success of any donor depends on their partners. And sometimes organizations forget that the donor needs the partners just as much as the other way around.
Yeah, but one thing I find remarkable is that you refer to your grantees as partners, which I think is a typical thing for DOB Ecology, that you want to learn from them and work with them.
Yeah, that's our ambition.
Long term, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't always, work that way because we make mistakes as well. But yes, I mean, we see them as partners because they determine our success. And yes, we play a crucial part in that because we help them through financing, but also through other things like network and linking partners to enable them to do that. But so it's a partnership, you know. Money is important, but their quality and their determination and their perseverance is just as important as the financing.
Well, this has been great, Mas. You know, and I'm eager to hear how this passes through the edit and plays back. You know, we're outside, but it's late. We recorded a few other episodes kind of on location in reserves, but never at night. So I'm curious to hear in the final edit just how much all the night sounds of the rainforest will come out. I think also in the distant background, there's a whole bunch of biologists from all over the world who are getting ready to actually go out into the forest at night, herpetologists, and there's a woman here who's an expert in dung beetles, and they spend most of the night in the dark in the forest doing their work, and I think they're not too far off talking before they head out. So
that's actually a good point you raised there, Scott, and I'm not sure whether we raised this in the podcast the last 30 minutes, but the importance and necessity of science and supporting science and funding science. The more we know, the better we equip to win this battle. And in my personal view, science is not funded enough, and we should, as donors, to put more effort into that.
That's a great point. So here with Mas, with Marlies, with the bugs and the forest, and the biologists, and really looking forward, Mas, to catching up again with you maybe next time when we're all out on a field visit somewhere and can carry this conversation forward. A real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Marlies.
Thanks for joining
Scott,
us,
for this.
Look Far is a U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to defending wild and wondrous places and working with the people living in and among them. More at lookfar.org.